Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of James. Last time we did verse 5, "Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he hath promised to them that love him?" And Lord willing, we're going to continue here today. And so I'll go ahead and start. It's verse 6. "But ye have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you and draw you before the judgment seats?" Here the apostle endeavors to work them in a sense of their own miscarriage, for having proved respect of persons a sin, he falls directly upon their consciences, "and you have been guilty of it, you have despised the poor." And then to show that their practice was not only vain and evil, but mad and senseless, he urges a new argument: "Do not rich men oppress you?" He does, in effect, ask them whether they would show so much honor to their executioners and oppressors. But you will say, does not the apostle herein stir them up to revenge? And are we not to love our enemies and to do good to them that hate us? I answer, number one, it is one thing to love enemies, another to esteem them out of some perverse respect, and there is a difference between fawning and offices of humanity and civility. Number two, some have deserved so ill of the church that they cannot challenge the least civil respect from the people of God. 3 John 10, "Bid him not Godspeed." So 2 Kings 3:14. "Were it not for Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee." Number three, the apostle does not speak to the persons, but to the case. Will you honor wealth, which is the visible cause of all mischief? You see that men of that rank and order are usually persecutors and blasphemers. He speaks of rich men in general, not such as used to frequent the church and synagogue. For otherwise, you mistake the apostle's argument if you think the words directed to the persons rather than the order. His argument runs thus: will you prefer men for wealth in the church when you see that none are so mischievous and such public enemies to the church as those that are wealthy? To prove that wealth is no sufficient ground of Christian respect, he urges the usual abuse of it. The next words, "but ye have despised the poor." He shows how contrary their practice was to God's dispensation. God has put honor upon them, but you dishonor them, as the original word signifies. The prophet expresses such a like sin thus, Amos 5:11, "Ye have trodden the poor underfoot." The next words, "do not rich men." Either he means rich pagans and Jews that had not embraced Christianity, persecutions usually arising from men of that sort and order, as the scribes, Pharisees, and high priests. The chief men of the city were stirred up against Paul and Barnabas, Acts 13, verse 50, or else pseudo-Christians, who, being great and powerful, oppressed their brethren and used all manner of violence toward them. Or rather, in general, any sort of rich men. Next words, "oppress you." The word is abuse their power against you or usurp a power over you which was never given them. In which sense, Solomon says in Proverbs 22, verse 7, "the rich ruleth over the poor and the borrower is servant to the lender." Ruleth, that is, arrogates a power, though not invested with the honor of magistracy. The next words, "and draw you before the judgment seats." If it be understood of the unconverted Jews, the meaning is they helped forward the persecution, and implies the same with that, Matthew 10:17, "they shall deliver you up to councils." Or if of rich men in general, to which I rather incline, it notes the violent practices which they used to the poor, dragging them as they used to do with their debtors. "He plucked him by the throat," Matthew 18:28. And the prophet Isaiah expresses the same cruelty by smiting with the fist of wickedness, Isaiah 58:4. "A great liberty the creditor had over the debtor among the Jews, and that our apostle intimates in the words, they draw you. And when he adds, before judgment seats, he aggravates this wickedness that was now grown customary among them, which was not only violent usage of the poor, but oppressing them under a form of law, either wearing them out by vexatious suits or defrauding them presently of their right through the favor which they obtained by their power and greatness, a practice common among all nations, but especially among the Jews, and therefore it is everywhere noted in the scriptures. See Psalm 10, verses 9 and 10. The notes are these. Observation number one, from that despised the poor, that known and apparent guilt must be roundly charged. Nathan said to David, 2 Samuel 12, verse 7, thou art the man. When the practice is notorious, a faint accusation does no good. The prophet strikes David on the breast. This is your sin. When a city is on fire, will a man come coldly and say, yonder is a great fire. I pray God it does no harm. No, he will cry, fire, fire, you are undone if you do not quench it. So when the practice is open and clearly sinful, it is not good to come with a contemplative lecture and lame homily, like a cripple homily, I assume that's what lame means there, but to fall to the case directly. You have despised the poor. Sirs, this is your sin, and if you do not reform it, this will be your ruin. It is good to be a little warm when the sin is common and the danger imminent. Observation two, from that but you, he opposes their practice to God's dispensation that despising the poor is a sin not only against the word and written will of God, but his mind and intent in his works and dispensations. It is a kind of gigantomachy, a resisting of God. Number one, it is against the mind of God in their creation. Proverbs 22, verse 2, the rich and the poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them both. That is, they meet in this, that they have but one maker. There is another meeting, Job 3, 15. They meet in the grave. They meet in their death and in their maker. Now, God never made a creature for contempt. These considerations should restrain it. They were made as we were, and they die as we do. The poor man is called our flesh, Isaiah 58, verse 7, Adam's child as we are. Number two, it is against God's providence, his common providence, who has constituted this order in the world, Proverbs 17, verse 5, whoso reproacheth the poor despiseth his maker, that is, contemns the wise dispensation of God, who would have the world to consist of hills and valleys, and the poor intermingled with the rich. Therefore Christ says in Matthew 26:11, the poor you have always present with you. It is one of the settled constitutions of laws of providence, and it is necessary for the uses and services of the world. This preserves order. There are many offices and functions which human societies cannot want or lack, and therefore some men's spirits are fitted for handicrafts and hard manual labors to which men of a higher spirit and delicate breeding will not condescend. Number three, it is also against God's special providence by which many times the greatest gifts are bestowed upon them that are poor and despicable in the world. Their wit being sharpened by necessity, they may have the clearer use of reason. Naaman's servant saw more than his master, 2 Kings 5:13, and Solomon tells of a poor man that delivered the city, Ecclesiastes 9, verse 15. Nay, God many times puts that singular honor of being heirs of salvation upon them. The poor are rich in faith in the context, and then injury must needs redound to him, for they are his friends and children, and friends have all things common, both courtesies and injuries. Observation three, rich men are usually persecutors or oppressors. Their wickedness has the advantage of an occasion. And usually when a disposition and an occasion meet together, then sin is drawn forth and discovered. Many have will, but have no power. The world would be a common stage to act all manner of villainies upon, were it not for such restraints of providence. Therefore, Solomon makes an oppressing poor man to be a kind of wonder and prodigy. Besides, riches exalt the mind and effervate it. They have had little experience of misery, and so have little pity. God's motives to Israel were these: do good to strangers, for you were a stranger, and do good to the poor, for your father was a poor Syrian. Such reasonings are frequent in Scripture. But now, when men live altogether at ease, their hearts are not meekened with a sense of the accidents and inconveniences of the common life. And therefore, having power in their hands, they use it, as beasts do their strength, in acts of violence. The prophet often complains in Amos 6 of the excellency of Jacob and the oppression that was in her palaces. Again, wealth often ends in pride, and pride breaks all common and moral restraints, and so men make their will a law and think as if the rest of the world were made to serve their pleasures. And besides, the world fills their hearts with a ravenous desire to have more of the world, how unjustly soever it be purchased and gotten. You see the reason why they are oppressors and they are persecutors, because commonly the meanest or lowest are most forward in religion. The spirit of the world and the spirit of Christ are at enmity. The gospel puts men upon the same level, which persons elevated and exalted cannot endure. Besides, they are afraid that the things of Christ will bring some disturbance to their worldly concernments and possessions. The Jewish rulers were afraid of division among the people and the coming in of the Romans. The Gadarenes were afraid of their hogs. Many such reasons might be given. Well then, rich men should be more careful to avoid the sins that seem to cleave to their rank and order. It is very hard, but with God all things are possible. Wealth is called the mammon of unrighteousness, Luke 16:9, because it is usually the instrument and incentive of it, of unrighteousness. That of Jerome is harsh, but too often true, that every rich man is either an oppressor himself or the heir of one, the inheritor of one. Certainly it is, but almost impossible to be rich and righteous. It's nearly impossible. There are many evils incident to your state, rich man. Moral evils, such as heathens discerned as pride, charge them that they be not high-minded, 1 Timothy 6:17. Boasting, with some contempt of others, Jeremiah 9:23, let not the rich man glory in his riches. So injustice, Proverbs 22:7, the rich ruleth over the poor, that is, by force and violence. The word may be read domineers. Then luxury and profaneness. Men abuse the fatness of their portion and lay it out upon their lusts. And lust in the Puritan writings and even in the Bible often is just simply corrupt desires of the heart, not just sexual. So they lay their money out for their whatever the corrupt desires of their hearts are. Dives fared deliciously every day. I believe Dives is the rich man in the rich man and Lazarus story that Christ told. But there are also spiritual evils, which are worse, because they lie more closely and undiscerned. These are, number one, forgetting of God when he has remembered them most. Men that live at ease have little or no sense of duty. Agur prayed, give me not riches, lest I be full and deny thee, Proverbs 30, verse 9. And number two, creature confidence. Hence those frequent cautions, 1 Timothy 6:17, trust not in uncertain riches. And Psalms 62:10, if riches increased, set not your hearts upon them. Usually the creatures rival God, and when we enjoy them in abundance, it is hard to keep off the heart from trust in them. Number three, worldliness. We are tainted by the objects with which we usually converse, and the more men have, the more sparing for God's uses and their own. Solomon speaks of riches kept by the owners to their hurt, Ecclesiastes 5:13. And there is an expression in the book of Job, chapter 22, verse 22, in the fullness of his sufficiency, he shall be in straits. There is no greater argument of God's curse than to have an estate and not to enjoy it. And so number four, security. Luke 12:19, soul, take thine ease, thou hast goods laid up for many years. These are evils that cleave to wealth like rust to money. I have but named them because I would not digress into illustrations. All right, and that is the end of verse 6, and we will go ahead and continue on. Verse 7, do not they blaspheme that worthy name by which ye are called? He proceeds in reckoning up the abuses of riches, who are the enemies of God and of religion, the scorners of the worthy name of Christians, but the rich. The words he goes through now, do not they blaspheme? Some interpret it of the carnal rich men that professed religion as if by the scandal of their practices they had brought an odium and ill report upon Christianity itself, so that they blaspheme in their sense is they cause to blaspheme. They think it is a Hebraism. The whole stream of interpreters run this way. They urge for it those parallel places, Romans 2:24. Through you is the name of God blasphemed among the Gentiles. And 2 Peter 2:2, by them is the way of truth evil spoken of, that is, by their means. And that in the first epistle of Timothy, chapter 6, verse 1, let servants be obedient, that the name of God and his doctrine be not blasphemed. And Titus 2, verse 5, the wives should be discreet and chaste, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Certainly, religion is never more dishonored than by the lives of carnal professors of religion. But this is the great mistake of this context to apply what is here spoken to rich Christians. The apostle only gives an observation of the manners of the rich of that age. They were usually such as were bitter enemies to Christianity, and thereupon infers that wealth was not a valuable consideration in the church to prefer men to places of rule and honor, or to further their cause whenever it came into debate. The next words, that worthy name, or honorable, as before, is in verse 3. In a good place is in the original honorably. The next words, by which ye are called, in the original, which is called upon you. And some interpret that thus, which you call upon. It is made a description of Christians, 1 Corinthians 1:2, all that call upon the name of Christ, and 2 Timothy 2:18, let him that nameth the name of Christ, or it's interpreted thus, which is called upon over you, that is in baptism, Matthew 28:19 and Acts 2:38, or rather, as we translate it, by which ye are called, for that is the proper import of that phrase, called upon you. It is applied to wives that are called after the name of the husband, Isaiah 4 verse 1, let thy name be called upon us, or to the children as Genesis 48:16, let my name be called upon them and the name of my fathers, etc. And so it implies the name of Christ, which is put upon his people who sustain these relations to him of spouse and children. Now the notes are these. Observation number one, that wicked rich men, above all others, are most prone to blasphemy. They set their hearts as the heart of God, Ezekiel 28 verses 5 and 6. Riches beget pride, and pride ends in atheism. Besides, they, enjoying a most liberal use of the creature, like money, are apt to talk unseemly. When their hearts are warmed and inflamed with wine and mirth, they cannot contain, but must needs disgorge their malice upon the ways and servants of Christ. The merry and full-fed Babylonians must have a Hebrew song, Psalm 137. And it is no feast with many unless John the Baptist's head be brought in a charger. Religion or religious persons must be served in to feed the mirth and support and sportiveness. Observation 2, they that love Christ will hate blasphemers. When he would work them into a disesteem of these ungodly wretches, he says, do they not blaspheme that worthy name? Moses burned with a holy zeal when he heard that one had blasphemed God, Leviticus 24, 13 and 14. And David said in Psalm 139, verses 20 to 22, they speak against thee wickedly, thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them that hate thee? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Love is tender of the least wrong done to the thing beloved. More especially will it sparkle and burn with a fiery zeal when such high contempt is cast upon it as blasphemy puts upon Christ. Those Gallios of our time that can so tamely and without any indignation hear the worthy name of Christ profaned with execrable blasphemies show how little love they have to him. David counted them his enemies that spoke wickedly against his God, but such are their darlings, I guess in his day. Observation 3, that Christ's name is a worthy name. Christianity will never be a disgrace to you. You may be a disgrace to Christianity. I am not ashamed, says the Apostle Paul, of the gospel of Christ, Romans 1:16. Many are ashamed to own their profession in carnal company, as if there could be any disgrace in being Christ's servant. Oh, it is an honor to you. And as Christianity is an honor to you, so should you be an honor to it, that you may not stain a worthy name. Adorn the gospel, Titus 2, verse 10. The herd of the wicked men, they are persons unknown and unobserved. They may sin and sin again, yet the world takes no notice of it. But how does it furnish the triumphs of the uncircumcised of heart to see men of a worthy name overtaken in an offense, for the world to see a Christian fall basically in sin? The hams of the world will laugh to see a Noah drunk. Spots and stains in white are soon discerned. Observation 4, the people of Christ are named and called after Christ's name, Christians from Christ. The apostle says, Ephesians 3:15, from him the whole family, both in heaven and earth, is named. The name was first given them at Antioch, Acts 11:26. They were called disciples before, but to distinguish them from false brethren, they named themselves Christians. They were called Nazarites and Galileans by their enemies, and about this time there was a sect of that name, half Jews and half Christians. Now the very name presses us to care and holiness. Remember what Christ did. You are called after his name, 2 Timothy 2:19. Let everyone that nameth the name of Christ depart from iniquity. He that counts it his honor to use the name of Christ in invocation. Alexander the Great said to one of his captains, that was also called Alexander, see, you do nothing unworthy of the name of Alexander. So see, you do nothing unworthy of the name of Christ. And as another said, speaking of something unbeseeming, I could do it if I were not Themistocles. So I could do it if I were not a Christian. Or as Nehemiah, should such a man as I flee? Or shall I, that am named by the name of Christ, do this or such and such thing? Again, this name is an argument which you may use to God in prayer for grace and mercy. His name is upon you that endears you to his bowels. God's promises are made to such, if the people that are called by my name, etc. 2 Chronicles 7:14. And so there is a notable promise, Deuteronomy 28, verse 10, "And all the people of the earth shall see that thou art called by the name of God, and they shall be afraid of thee." So you shall see the church pleading this, Jeremiah 14, verse 9, "Yet thou, O Lord, art in the midst of us, and we are called by thy name. Leave us not." So may you go to God, "Lord, it is thus with us, but we are called by thy name." And you may go to him as that, as a child of his. All right, and that is the end of verse 7. And we'll go ahead and stop there for now. And Lord willing, go on the next time. But until then, go in a concern for Christ in his name and how we all represent him to the world. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.